Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 4 of Journeys, a podcast on transportation. I'm your host, Matteo Bellotto. Today, we're joined by a very special guest, Tom Wright. Tom is the president and chief executive of the Regional Plan Association, the nation's oldest independent metropolitan research, planning, and advocacy organization. He's a frequent public speaker and commentator on regional governance, economic growth, and development, transit investments, and other policy issues. In his 20-plus years with RPA, he has participated in many key initiatives, including the historic Civic Alliance to rebuild downtown New York following the September 11 attacks, the campaign to create a mixed-use district at Manhattan's Hudson Yards, the protection of New Jersey Highlands, and a vision plan for the city of Newark. Previously, Tom was deputy executive director of the New Jersey State Office of Planning, where he coordinated the production of the New Jersey State Development and Redevelopment Plan. In January 2020, Governor Phil Murphy appointed Tom as the chairman of the New Jersey State Planning Commission. Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great. Nice to be here today.
So the first kind of question I want to talk about for listeners who don't know is the role of RPA, the Regional Plan Association, and the role of regional plans, and kind of where you straddle the line between the public and private sectors.
Sure. That's a good place to start. Because one of the unique things about Regional Plan Association is that we are a private nonprofit. We have no official charter. We get no funding from the public sector other than occasionally a contract here or there or something. The recommendations and the policies we promote and the plans we write have absolutely zero weight of law. And often I will find myself speaking somewhere around the country or around the world, and somebody will say, oh, I run the Regional Plan Association for Nashville or for Madrid or Paris. And at the end, they're always public sector entities. And there's a fundamental difference. Now, you know, by being on the outside, we don't have the imprimatur, we don't have the official standing. The recommendations that we make can be and sometimes are ignored by politicians in the public sector. On the other hand, the issues that we work on in particular, and it's around long-term issues, so we don't focus on 1, 2, 3 year things, but things that are going to take 5, 10, 15, 20 years to achieve. We look across political boundaries. So we don't care whether a job locates on the east side of the Hudson River or the west side of the Hudson River. We want to work. I like to point out there are 782 towns and cities in the tri-state region that we work on. One of them is New York City, and it's roughly 8.5 million people. 781 are not, and they are in three different states around 31 different counties. And so by being outside government, we are able to speak more clearly to the issues specifically that we work on, which includes transportation, landscape preservation, community development, housing, all those kinds of issues.
So I've read a portion of the fourth regional plan, and something I noticed, especially on transportation, is that you say that transportation is not an end to itself, that it integrates with housing, neighborhood development, economic opportunity, climate resilience. So I'm kind of curious what a holistic approach to transportation looks like and how it relates to all these other, you know, factors.
Sure. That's a great question. I mean, in a larger context, and RPA has been around for about a century. So over our history, we've kind of been part of the modern, 20th and now 21st century planning around transportation and seen the rise of the automobile and the interstate system, the decline and then rebirth of urban mass transit. And now hopefully something new, which both connects isolated communities, reduces our carbon footprint and other things. We are always reminded that transportation is not, our goal is not just to kind of build more trains and fill them up. It's to try and achieve the outcomes. In the fourth plan, what we talk about is health, equity, sustainability, and prosperity, and achieving all four of those goals together. Transportation is obviously a very important part of that. How we get around determines whether or not the air we breathe is clean, whether people have access to jobs, et cetera. But it's a very different lens of looking at these kinds of issues.
And kind of along the lines of transportation and the things that it dictates, I heard you speaking, I think, on WNYC with Alec Baldwin, and there's a conversation there about infrastructure, And I remember that really sticking out to me, because in the plan you say that you haven't sufficiently reformed planning, management, and labor practices to reduce the high costs and slow pace of building new infrastructure. And you know, it's true, every politician loves to cut the new ribbon, but I'm curious how, you know, where's the will come to keep maintenance up, and specifically, like, what has to be reformed, especially maybe in regard to unions, so that infrastructure can be cheaper to maintain?
Sure. We did a kind of forensic analysis of the MTA's mega regions. First off, I'll point out that, again, when you take the long-term view of this, we built, you know, the subway system over a couple of decades at the beginning of the last century, and we built these and these commuter rail systems and others, and then we walked away from them for several generations. And essentially in the 50s and 60s and 70s, it was solely highway building. And then suddenly towards the end of the last century, we started first to repair and just get our subway system back and running, and then started slowly to expand the system. 9/11 happens, all of a sudden, you know, the PATH system is knocked out, the subways in lower Manhattan are knocked out. And we kind of come back in a relatively short period of time with these mega projects, Second Avenue Subway, which we've championed being the biggest and most expensive, but the East Side Access, which will open in about 2 years, allowing Long Island Railroad riders. Most people are unaware of this. In 2 years, people living on Long Island will have the option every morning of taking a train either to Grand Central or Penn Station, whereas today they can only get to Penn Station. Huge project. And then the other is the number 7 extension over to Hudson Yards, which isn't quite as large, but did essentially open up the redevelopment there. We looked very closely at the practices and what happened with them. And essentially what we concluded is the process is flawed from beginning to end, every single step of the way. You ask about unions, and yes, there are labor practices that are ridiculous. Virtually the same tunnel boring machine technology that's used in other parts of the world where 6 people can operate a machine somewhere else. For some reason in New York City, it requires 4 times as many people. Is it a difference of the rock or the technology? No, it's just work rules. It's just literally padding the contracts. And so we have a lot of problems with that. But that's not the only, you know, I'll say labor often feels that they become the scapegoat on this, and they're right. Because there are a lot of other problems, literally with the way the projects are scoped, the procurement process, liability protections. The funding isn't even in place. I mean, again, I'll pick on Second Avenue Subway. They built the first phase of it. At the completion of the first phase, there was a tunnel boring machine embedded under the bedrock on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. We all know that eventually we want to go further south. So the smart thing to do would have been to continue digging south with the machine in place. But no, because the project was segmented and there wasn't funding in place at the time, we went through the very expensive proposition of dismantling and pulling that machine out. And someday somebody will have to go pay to put it back in again. Mm. Over and over and over again, we really have the worst of all possible worlds in terms of this. The MTA has been doing very hard work to try and bring these costs down and control what they can control. Some of it is out of their control, but much of it is in. And actually, literally last week, they announced a first set of new contracts with a construction crew, a contractor, to do station upgrades. And this is part of the important work of making sure that subway stations in New York City are ADA, that people with disabilities can access them. That first crop of station upgrades came in at about half the cost that the MTA had originally estimated. We're used to the costs being 100% over budget. This was 50% of budget. And the main difference, the MTA all says, is we've done hard work on streamlining our contracting, on clarifying what we're going to do. We're not going to make thousands of change orders at the last minute. And the contractors agreed to a lower cost because they had some certainty from us about these issues. And that's just incredibly important, because the cost of building a subway mile in New York City is roughly 4 times what it is in high cost places like London and Paris, places with good, you know, labor protections and other things too. And so we need to try and start to come down to the global norms.
Yeah, that was fascinating actually in that interview, hearing that large contracting companies who build large infrastructure projects in regard to public transportation in Europe won't work in New York, or won't work.
They literally won't work here. I mean, that When a huge bid goes out and one or two companies bid on them instead of five or six, you know you're not going to get the best cost. And so I really do applaud. The MTA leadership has been doing great work on trying to reform this, and it's hard, slow work on the inside. It's not sexy. But there are other pieces around this. And again, it's the way we, the funding that we provide, it, by not being certain in the first place, it kind of requires them to make all kinds of short-term decisions. I mean, in some ways, people ask me, why is East Side Access taken, you know, roughly 15 years to build? And I would say because they couldn't do it in 25 years. Because in a way, at the MTA, every dollar they spend on East Side Access is a dollar that they could have spent on operations or something else. And if they slow down the project, that gives them more money to do other things with in the short term. You know, when you look at the way these projects have been, Crossrail in London is the nearest comparable to this. They essentially set up separate entities just to deliver the projects. What the MTA has done is set up a new division within the MTA, given that kind of attention. The big one in the future, I mean, the biggest project that we're all paying attention to now is called Gateway, and that's building new tunnels under the Hudson River. This is the Amtrak-owned Northeast Corridor tunnels that connect New York to New Jersey are now 110 years old. They flooded during Superstorm Sandy. They move a couple of feet every day with the tides. In the winter, they have to run trains through to knock the icicles off the ceiling. You know, why are there icicles in a train underneath the Hudson River? Because it leaks. So we have to build new tunnels, both to create more capacity. It's the weakest link in the entire Boston to Washington rail corridor. It's an enormous growth area. I mean, there's been most of the growth of new commuters into Manhattan for the last 25 years have been coming from west of the Hudson. So we need to do this huge project, and we're going to need to do it in a smarter and better way. And this is going to be, I mean, this will be really what Pete Buttigieg and as DOT secretary is going to be facing as a challenge, is can he reform the system and start to bring in some of these, you know, some of these models that we see work in other parts of the world?
I do have a question about, you know, Biden's future transportation plans, but I, you know, I know you only have 10, you know, minutes left. So I just want to cover a couple more questions. And kind of speaking about new entities, in the fourth regional plan, you talk about creating a public benefit corporation for subway reconstruction. So I'm kind of curious how creating a separate corporation enhances or benefits the MTA.
So our thinking with that recommendation was, part of the problem when we looked again at these projects at the MTA, part of the problem would be that there was always kind of competition between the operating divisions, which were trying to run the systems even as they're expanding them, and often weren't really getting involved in the process until very late, and then suddenly making an enormous amount of changes to the projects. And famously, Second Avenue Subway, you know, there was a kind of deadline. Governor Cuomo said, this thing's going to be running on New Year's Eve. I was on that first train with him and everybody celebrating. But to get there, the MTA did literally thousands of change orders. And you would have a process where the contractors would be under contract to build a piece of the system. And then they would realize that they didn't no longer needed that piece of the system, or that they were going to need it in a different way. But because of the contracting and procurement process, they would still be required to build it, show that they'd completed it, get paid, and then tear it down during the construction to then, you know, renovate it. So, and a lot of that was, again, a kind of friction between the capital and the operating side of things. And so what we said is create a new public benefit corporation that's just focused on the capital, that's building, and that doesn't do the change orders and has, you know, somebody has to, essentially the buck has to stop somewhere. What the MTA did was they didn't kind of create a separate entity the way we had called for, but what they did do was really consolidate all of the competing factions under this new development corporation that's internal to the MTA. Now, this was, you know, to some degree, this played out in the press. We had an extraordinary president of the Transit Authority, the operating division, Andy Byford, and he saw some of the work that he wanted to do, like the signal upgrades and other things, being taken away from him, and he quit, and he now runs the London system. And that's regrettable because Andy's terrific. But in many ways, I would argue that structurally and institutionally, what the MTA was doing was the right thing. and they were actually following our recommendations. They just, they managed to kind of do it within the existing structure rather than creating an external division.
So I just have two more questions, if that's okay. The sure. first one is in regard to the 15-minute city concept. It's a question that I've asked every single guest I've had on the show, and I've had wildly different answers, and you know they're always fascinating. So, you know, for guests who don't know, I just want to quickly give a summary of what it is. Sure. It's basically the idea that you can live in a certain area and have your essential needs 15 minutes away from you. So school, groceries, pharmacy, work, in kind of a 15-minute radius. Some cities have planned it for 15 minutes via public transportation, but most cities are doing it 15 minutes walking. Paris, Barcelona are some cities that are really pioneering it right now in the world. And it seems to be an interesting model and idea for how we can live in our urban spaces. So I'm curious if you think it's a practical idea, yeah. if it could manifest itself in the Tri-State area. Overall,
sure,
your thoughts.
Sure. Look, I think it's a very powerful idea. The thing about it is I could show you diagrams from the 1929 first regional plan with the neighborhood district planning concept, which is exactly the same thing, essentially. Chris Ward, the brilliant former executive director of the Port Authority, once said to me, he said, you know, there are no new ideas in planning. It's more like somebody kind of lays an issue and a thought down, and then somebody puts one on top of it and another on top of it. He actually compared it, he's smarter than I am. He said it's in musical composition, you'd call this a fugue, where there's a kind of theme that gets laid down and then it gets repeated and repeated and repeated. When I first read about C40 and the 15-minute concept, I said, oh, well, this is like the new urbanists of the 1990s or the, you know, or the new regionalists of the 1920s. It's a very, but I think, of course, what they're doing is bringing to it the ideas of carbon emissions and climate change. They're bringing to it equity and other things. So I don't want to be completely dismissive. I think that these are powerful concepts. These are powerful tools for explaining what we should be doing. And the kind of shocking thing isn't whether or not the 15-minute city is a good idea, but why haven't we gone further in actually achieving these outcomes? Why is it still, with all of that we know about how communities work, and you know, you look at 2008 and the market bubble, which communities lost the value the most? It's the ones that were the boom burbs and the exurbs that were all kind of monocultures. And which ones retained their value? It was the walkable communities that had a diversity of uses and incomes and races and everything else like that. And yet, still, I'll open up, you know, a journal, a newspaper, something, and look at a new concept plan that's proposed. And over here will be all the housing, and over there will be the commercial district, and all the rich people are here and the poor people. And you think, what, haven't we learned anything? Why are we still making plans like this that look like they come right out of, you know, the 1950s? And so we need these kinds of concepts to keep relearning the lessons that we should have learned before and reforming our planning practice. Look, the thing that's been most influential for us, I think at RPA, for me personally, I picked up Richard Rothstein's book a couple of years ago at Newark Airport when I was on my way on a trip after a conference, and thought, oh, this looks, it's called The Color of Law, if you haven't seen it.
Oh, yes.
And it's about, you know, essentially the kind of the segregation and racist, you know, DNA and embedded in our zoning and planning laws. And it really shocked me. I thought I knew all that. I'd read my Ken Jackson. I thought, you know, I'd worked in these communities. I'd read these plans. And yet I was really shocked at what Rothstein unearthed and how fundamental that is to our communities. So we've got to do a better job at breaking down segregation, creating opportunities for more diversity, using the mechanisms we have, land use, transportation, other things, to create more integrated, comprehensive, healthy communities. And we're really just not doing it. And it's kind of shocking given how much we know. Time for one more question.
Yeah. So my last question is kind of the question I usually ask at the end. And it kind of has to do with future technology. So I'm kind of curious how you think autonomous vehicles, maybe Hyperloop, if you've done some research into that. You know, I'm quite curious if you think that they'll have, you know, any impact on our future transportation planning, or if, you know, you believe that we have the tools we need right now to succeed and create a happy and healthy urban city, and that these future technologies are mere distractions, you know,
I mean, Hyperloop, it seems kind of confounding to me. And at the same time, Jay Walter runs it, and he's one of the greatest, you know, transportation planners and thinkers of our generation. So I'm not going to bet against him. But I think in your question is embedded. I mean, there are always interesting new technologies, and certainly micromobility and bike share and the new scooters. I haven't ridden a scooter yet, I'll admit. I'm afraid I'll you know, smash my head. But we were early advocates of the bike share concept and creating bike lanes. City bike membership is an employee benefit at Regional Plan Association. We give it to every employee. We pay for their annual membership. And I think all major employers in the city should do that. And so technology has, and what's kind of brilliant about that, of course, is it's a marrying of a very old technology, the human-powered bicycle, with new technology that allows you to, you know, to create the payment system and the tracking and all of that. And I think that that's kind of the answer to this, is that we're going to see new technology enabling things like biking and walking and other things. I think that e-commerce has exploded during COVID and is not about to go down. We have to figure out ways, of course, to support local retail, but we're also going to have to figure out how to handle all of these deliveries and, you know, multiple packages being delivered to a single address over the course of a day, mm-hmm. and people ordering everything from groceries to whatnot. And so I think transportation is going to evolve a great deal. Autonomous vehicles, I remember the first time I rode out in I went out to California to test drive the Zoox system a couple of years ago. For the first time, I was on I-95 with a friend in his Tesla, and he took his hands off the wheel, and it freaked me out. I think that, you know, nobody knows exactly how these things are going to play out. The urban setting is going to be a real challenge for autonomous vehicles. My guess is that what we'll see fairly soon, though, is freight, you know, interstate trucking happening more and more by autonomous vehicles on the highway system. And we're going to see simultaneously more districts starting to, I mean, one of the big changes from COVID is people now look at their streets differently. New York City started this under Jeanette Sadek Khan, and it was continued under Commissioner Polly Trottenberg. But we've been kind of experimenting with our streets in New York, and we've seen the space between the curbs as mutable. I think that's probably a big revelation for a lot of other American cities, but it's something that is taking seed and taking hold. And so there's going to be more thinking, more creativity, more dynamism in how public space between buildings and sidewalks and streets are designed, and trying to accommodate future modes of travel. And again, when you combine this with people maybe working from home a day or two a week and not quite commuting quite as often, that's going to create more demands for, you know, what that home environment is like. Or if people are going to go into an office, a friend at Sidewalk Labs has argued this to me very persuasively, it's going to have to be the office environment. It's going to have to be a place people want to go. They don't have to be there, but they would want to be there. Now, I miss Midtown Manhattan right now. I wish I could walk around in the streets and go to a restaurant and go to the museum. And my expectation is when I have the ability to do that, I'm going to partake more in that. And so places like, you know, in some ways, this is still going to kind of pull apart society, and communities that can provide that attractive competitive advantage will do very well, and other places won't. And so, you know, it is a really dynamic moment in transportation planning, with the new technology coming on, with the new ways of working and travel and behaviors coming on. I'm very excited to see what comes out of it. I think that the next 10 years may be, you know, as dramatic as the opening up of the interstate highway system, or the shift from, you know, horse-drawn carts to autonomous to self-driven vehicles. So we're gonna see a lot change, and I think it'll be incumbent on kind of our public leaders to, you know, both manage but not resist too much that change either. Communities that try and shut down will be the ones that lose out. And planners and citizens and advocates and all have to get involved and make sure that we do it the right way. I am worried in the community I'm sitting in here right now that some of the changes they're going to make to the streets are actually going to drive local retail out of business. So it's not like it's clear what we got to do. And I think it's going to be complicated, but it's also going to be very exciting.
I think that's a good note to end on. So I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me. I know you're very busy. This is a very fascinating episode.
Sure. Great talking to you, Mateo.